Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, March 12, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. An illness many Americans overlook is making a strong resurgence, especially in Black Hawk County. The number of tuberculosis cases has tripled since 2021. In 2023, the county had 13 active cases. When compared to the state and the U.S., based on the incidence rate per 100,000 people, Black Hawk County had a case rate of 6.1 in 2022, while the state had 1.9 and the country had 2.5. In 2023, the county had a case rate of 11.4. Last year's rate is not available for the state or the U.S. The most common symptoms of TB are a persistent cough, low-grade fevers, and night sweats. People can also cough up blood and unintentionally lose weight. TB is the second deadliest infectious killer after COVID-19. The bacteria is most often in the lungs and can spread through respiratory droplets in the air. There are two types of tuberculosis. Those with active TB are the ones who are infectious, but people can also have latent TB. These people have the germ, but it hasn't replicated enough to be infectious and stays within their system. Many people with latent infections do not have symptoms, but if it goes untreated, it can turn into an active case of TB. February was among Iowa's warmest and driest on record. February temperatures in Iowa averaged more than 12 degrees above normal this year, which makes it one of the warmest on record, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Whether it ranks as the first or second warmest, February in the past 150 years awaits analysis by the state climatologist. The month was also among the top three driest, with a statewide average of 0.21 inches of precipitation. That is less than a fifth of what is typically expected. Widespread drought conditions worsened slightly throughout the month, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. A very dry February has wiped out much of the benefit received from the wet January, said Tim Hall, Hydrology Resources Coordinator for the DNR. The encouraging trend that started the winter has not continued. January was the 18th wettest on record, with a statewide average of 1.71 inches of precipitation, about 76% more than normal. Two winter storms left record snowfall across southern Iowa, including a monthly total of 38.7 inches in Ottumwa. February snowfall averaged about 1.1 inches statewide, or about 5.7 inches less than what is typically expected. Climate outlooks indicate chances for a spring that is warmer and wetter than normal. The Federal Climate Prediction Center projects the drought conditions will improve in the southern half of the state. About 80% of the state is suffering from some degree of drought, with the driest soil conditions in the northeast quadrant of Iowa. All or parts of 30 counties have extreme drought, the second worst classification designated by the U.S. Drought Monitor. Drought has been present in parts of the state since July 2020, which makes it the longest drought in about 70 years. Conditions have improved since a peak of dryness in September, but the state is still by far the driest it's been in recent years, leading into the corn and soybean growing seasons. A Waterloo woman whose child was found with injuries in 2023 has received a suspended prison sentence. Dominique Nicole Lloyd, 25, pleaded to a charge of child endangerment causing bodily injury, reduced from child endangerment causing serious injury as part of a plea agreement. She was sentenced to up to 5 years in prison, suspended to 2 to 5 years of probation, and 1 year at a residential treatment center on February 18th. According to court records, Lloyd's child was found unresponsive with blood coming from the mouth, a brain hemorrhage, and bruises, as well as a bald spot on the head, indicating the child hadn't been moved for a significant amount of time. The child was taken to a local hospital and then transferred to University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics in Iowa City. Lloyd allegedly told officials the child fell from a sitting position and struck its head on a metal stand. Doctors said the injuries couldn't have happened as described in her account. As part of the sentencing, the court issued a restraining order barring her from contacting any of her children. The Salvation Army of Waterloo and Cedar Falls has named a new youth outreach director. Ashley Shavers comes to the Salvation Army Youth Center after having been an internal auditor at the Isle of Casino Hotel, a secretary in educational services at George Washington Carver Academy, and a paraeducator at Hoover Middle and Lincoln Elementary Schools. Shavers was selected for her years of experience building client relations and working with youth. The center hopes to reopen and be fully staffed by the beginning of April. Leadership is encouraging interested families to register their kids now. They must be enrolled in school and be between the ages of 6 to 17. If interested in applying for youth center positions, go online to bit.ly/49fieys. For more information or registration, visit the Salvation Army at 89 Franklin Street or call 319-235-9358. The city wins a railroad study grant funds. The City of Waterloo has been awarded a $750,000 grant for a study on the relocation of the downtown railroad yard. The money comes from the Neighborhood Access and Equity Program, dispersed by the Office of the Secretary of Transportation. The study would look at moving an active railroad yard from downtown Waterloo to the outskirts of town, as well as safety improvements along the corridor. The move could ease traffic flow and improve safety along the corridor. In Cedar Falls, a large privately owned fraternity house is available to purchase for $1.3 million in a prominent spot on the outskirts of the UNI campus. Sigma Alpha Epsilon brothers, who still live in the 14,122 square foot building at 1115 West 23rd Street, said that membership numbers and finances had to do with deciding to right size and move on from the house. The two-story house dates back to 1998, takes up a sizable portion of the block, and may be known by passerbys as the building with two white lion statues out front. It also has a purple roof and an emblem blinking with multiple colors. Back then, when we built the building, we were near 100 members, but you've seen what's happened to the university enrollment, and we've had similar reductions, said Robert Lee, president of the Iowa Chi Chapters House Corporation. That's led to a situation where the fraternity essentially had to force members to live there, and the reality is that even with the attempts, the chapter has open beds. He said the housing corporation, which owns the building, is doing really well financially, but you don't cash flow without every member living there to pay rent to cover expenses like utilities, upkeep, and property taxes. fall and spring 2023 academic reports, available on UNI's website, had the Iowa Chi chapter's membership at 24 and 29, respectively, down from a spring 2022 total of 42. The oldest available report from spring 2013 had membership at 59. The members will continue to live there through late May, and hopefully by then a sale is finalized, said Lee. Members will be on their own for housing the next academic year, but Lee is confident that in the future the chapter will identify smaller living quarters, possibly for less than 10 members, maybe just officers, in order for some brothers to live together. Sigma Alpha Epsilon, known by many as SAE, hosts its annual Patty Murphy Week philanthropy in the springtime and has more than 220 chapters nationwide. A Facebook post from November 15, 2015, noted the day as marking the 100th anniversary of the fraternity at the University of Northern Iowa and 50th anniversary as a Sigma Alpha Epsilon chapter, after being originally founded as the Alpha Chi Epsilon Fraternity. January 22nd real estate listing, first reported by the Northern Iowan, labels the building as being capable of housing 48 people and the half acre as a redevelopment opportunity, zoned R3, for potentially multifamily housing, a religious or campus-related purpose. The asking price recently dropped from $1.3 million to $1.225 million. The city's GIS database indicates about 9 rental properties immediately to the north and west surround the fraternity house. The St. Stephen the Witness Catholic Student Center is next door to the east, and the university's parking ramp is a stone's throw away to the west. The university is not forcing them to sell, and the fraternity chapter, one of only two recognized by the institution in its 2023 reports versus the four in 2013, is not facing any disciplinary action, according to Josh Ferris, UNI Fraternity and Sorority Life Coordinator. They're doing what makes sense for them, Ferris said. They're still an active fraternity, and we will continue to support them whether they have a house or not. He said UNI is not really involved in fraternity housing decisions, especially when it involves a private building, and therefore could not provide additional details related to the rationale. The real estate listing further explains the house has 24 bedrooms, a kitchenette, library, recreation room, breakfast area, lounge, other common area space, and a walkout level in the back, with a 27-vehicle parking lot accessible from a Myrner Avenue drive. We've gotten serious interest, said Matt Mahey, the official's commercial and residential group broker handling the listing when reached by telephone. UNI is not interested in the property at this time, a spokesman and Lee said. Mahey declined to name the possible suitors. Lee says demolition, or in his words, starting over, hasn't been discussed. It was a very hard decision. Nobody wanted it to come to this, but everyone agrees that it has to happen, said Lee, adding that the active student members are completely on board. Plan B was recruiting more members, and that just wasn't happening. Blake Saylor, president of the Iowa Chi chapter's active student members, and Dave Pascarella, director of communications for the North American fraternity, did not respond to emails seeking comment. The developer who revitalized the Red Fox Inn is dealing with some major financial challenges. A pending foreclosure was made known last week at the city council meeting, filed September 18th by CUSB Bank in district court against 1859 Ventures for defaulting on its mortgage-backed notes totaling $5.66 million. The financing fueled the major undertaking that resulted in the successful restoration of the hotel, event center, and apartments at 1900 Heritage Way. The former inn had been derelict for years and was acquired by the city in 2020 after property taxes went unpaid. The municipality eventually gave the property to the developer to rehabilitate. Construction wrapped up a little over a year ago. As a result of the financial trouble, which includes a failure to pay a sizable amount of municipal property taxes, the council unanimously suspended its development agreement and the tax rebates associated with the property's redevelopment. The developer was slated to receive the rebates for 100% of the property taxes on the added commercial and residential value, not to exceed $500,000, beginning in June over the next 6 years, as well as 50% of the hotel-motel taxes the next 7 years, not to exceed $250,000. Since property taxes were not paid, there are no funds to pay the rebates, wrote City Attorney Bill Werger in a memo to the council. The agreement with the city may become effective again if assurances are received to cure its default and continue its performance, states the resolution approved by the council. However, Werger explained to the elected officials that the future is up in the air if 1859 Ventures loses the property to foreclosure. "We'll just have to wait and see," he said. "That's what we want to do here, just suspend the performance so we have time to think about it and have more information and find out what happens," he said. The court found out later that the notes were purchased by Barker Financial and ordered the firm replace CUSB as the plaintiff. Additionally, court records show several other suits opened against 1859 Ventures by subcontractors seeking payment and liens for work reportedly completed. Coming from LaPorte City, a preliminary investigation has found that a man discovered dead Sunday looks to have tripped and fallen into a bonfire while camping. Blackhawk County Sheriff's deputies responded at 10:03 a.m. to the report of a body found on a sandbar of the Cedar River between Gilbertville and LaPorte City. The investigation's findings indicate the man had been canoeing alone on the Cedar River at the time of the incident and had made a campsite on a sandbar for overnight sleeping. The name of the deceased is not being released at this time. An autopsy will be conducted by the Iowa State Medical Examiner. It's a big idea. Create a piece of art so small it fits inside a box that measures just 4.7 by 2.7 centimeters. I tried to measure the box with a ruler, and the dimensions are so small I had to use centimeters, said Corey Herless, Cedar Falls Cultural Program Supervisor and Executive Director at the Hearst Center for the Arts. Big Ideas Tiny Art 2024 is an innovative new art competition that will culminate in a summer exhibition at the Hearst Center. Entries are being accepted now through May 24th. The project is a first for the center. We wanted to come up with an art event that makes people think creatively. They'll have to think small, really small, said Herless, adding that she's excited about seeing what artists create. Participants must use fine arts mediums and techniques to conceptualize and create their miniature 2D artworks as well as 3D objects that measure 4.7 by 2.7 by 3 centimeters. The only thing that is off limits is 3D printing or digital design. We want the art to be handmade, she explained. The artwork must fit inside the box. Official tiny art boxes are available at the Hearst Center, one per person. The box is shaped like a miniaturized trunk with a decorative closure. Artists can paint or adorn the outside of the box, but what counts will be what is inside it. Each participant can submit a single entry. Anyone who enters the competition will have their piece put on display during the exhibition, May 30th through July 14th. For more official competition rules and regulations or an entry form, go online to thehearst.org. Free artist workshops will be offered to help artists in developing and executing their tiny art ideas. Kyle Kerwin, who creates art and designer toys and whimsical sculptures in his Des Moines studio, will present a workshop from 2 to 4 p.m. on April 6th. Inga Segner, art professor at Iowa State University in Ames, focuses on painting, mixed media, and assemblage. Her workshop is from 2 to 4 on April 13th. On April 30th, from 2 to 4 p.m., Hunley Song, a current Grant Wood Fellow in printmaking at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, will present a workshop. She works across a range of media, from printmaking and painting to sculpture and animation, to explore imagined worlds and personal mythologies. Cedar Falls artist Nat Gaynor, who works in a variety of media, including sculpture, digital, and traditional drawing mediums, will present the fourth workshop. The time and date is to be determined. There will be two Best in Show prizes awarded, Herless said, one determined by a jury vote of Cedar Valley art experts, and one winner determined by popular vote. An opening reception is planned from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Thursday at the Hearst Center, 304 West Searley Boulevard in Cedar Falls. The event is being hosted by Friends of the Hearst and Arts Midwest. Students converged at the Waterloo Career Center for the first time ever, LooCon. Getting more than 200 students to assemble for an afternoon to discuss artificial intelligence and information technology can seem daunting, but Waterloo Career Center teacher Kyle Coolers was up for the challenge. Said Coolers, who teaches web programming and cybersecurity courses, "I didn't know what to expect. Things went great. My goal was to have the students not only interact with professionals and schools, but to have an experience that makes them want to learn." Nearly 230 students from 29 school districts across Iowa showed up on Thursday for the first ever LooCon at the Career Center. They attended a forum with professionals from Unity Point Health, ProCircular, VGM, Forbin, and New Bohemian Innovation Collaborative. During the forum, the professionals answered questions about using artificial intelligence, how to succeed in such a competitive field, and what students can do now to prepare for college. One presenter advised the students to embrace their uniqueness, while a second advised them to be adaptive and to learn your resources. After lunch, students vied to win an Internet Capture the Flag competition. Students could choose from 80 puzzles of varying difficulty to win bragging rights for their school. Johnston High School from the Des Moines metro area placed first. A team from the Career Center placed second, and West Delaware County High School came in third. Aaron Sale, K-12 STEM coach for the Waterloo Community Schools, had nothing but praise for how the day turned out. "Kyle did such a good job organizing this event," she said. "Something I love about the opportunities Waterloo Schools brings to its students is that it also provides experiences for students in other districts and a chance to come together, learn and connect with each other and people in the community. I do have to give some credit to Erin Swancutt with Hawkeye Community College. She was instrumental in helping get everything off the ground, Coolers said. As instructors, we get so excited to trick the kids to learn. Every semester I do an IT day, and then I think for the spring we may do this going forward, Coolers said of LuCon. Ultimately, we could not have had a successful event without the support of Waterloo Community School Administration. They have been champions of this curriculum. A bill handling the development of community college aid distribution formulas to community college leaders will head to the Iowa State Senate floor after moving through committee. The Senate Appropriations Committee passed Senate File 2373, which would strike current code on the formula determining state funding allocations for each of the students' community college and form a council of community college presidents and chancellors to determine the formula on a yearly basis. As amended, the bill would have this president's council consider college enrollments, combined support, and other relative factors when determining the formula, and no college will receive fewer allocated funds than in previous years unless the base funding allocation itself has been reduced, Senator Tim Crayenbrink, Republican from Port Dodge, said. At least 10 of the 15 community college leaders would need to approve the formula for it to head to the Department of Education for implementation, according to the bill. And if a consensus cannot be reached by October 31st each year, the department will determine the formula instead. Crayenbrink said during the committee meeting that the bill came to lawmakers from the community colleges and schools that could see either increases or decreases in appropriations are fully backing it. The neat thing is that all 15 of the college presidents and chancellors voted 100% to support this, and very rarely do you get 100% of anybody that's on a winning or losing side to support something they believe in so much. And I think with the newness of a lot of our presidents and chancellors and community colleges, I think that they saw something that needed to be addressed, Crayenbrink said. Senator Cindy Winkler, a Democrat from Davenport, reiterated concerns she had previously expressed in subcommittee meetings about how students concurrently enrolled in high school and college courses would factor into the formula, as they are accounted in community college enrollment for funding, but the money those programs generate come through K-12 channels. She said she'd like to see concurrent programming represented in combined support when creating the formula, and that lawmakers continue to have access to breakdowns of how much funding each college would see under the new formula each year to be informed during the budgeting process. Crayenbrink said they should be able to cover these concerns as the bill moves ahead. Updating the distribution formula and giving it more flexibility year over year was one of the community college system's priorities for this legislative session, Indian Hills Community College President Matt Thompson said. His college is one that has been weighted at a higher level than others with the current funding formula, he said, and the goal of these changes is to provide more equity across the board. Thompson said the community colleges are seeking a $10 million increase in state aid this year, higher than in past sessions, in order to more quickly reach an equilibrium. Half of the funds would go to helping this balance, and the rest would be put into maintaining programs and handling higher costs. Thompson said, "We have received really unanimous support through the presidents, through the work that we've done to try to determine a solution that helps all of us across the state of Iowa maintain the high quality of programming that we offer our community colleges. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Tuesday, March 12th, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Kathy Lynn Albrecht of Cedar Falls, formerly of Reedland, passed away March 8th. Kathy was born June 1st, 1949. She graduated from Wapsie Valley High School in 1967 and lived in Des Moines for a short time following high school. Following her return to Reedland, Kathy attended Gates-Waterloo Business College and began her career at John Deere in October 1974. She worked in numerous roles there before her retirement in September 2009. Kathy was united in marriage to Floyd W. Albrecht, Jr. on March 1, 1985. She moved to the Martin Center in Cedar Falls in 2019. According to her wishes, Kathy's family will have a private celebration of life and no public service will be held. William J., known as Bill Fleck, 78, of LaPorte City, died Friday, March 8, 2024, at his home. He was born January 25, 1946, in Waterloo. He graduated from LaPorte City High School in 1964 and served in the United States Army Reserves during the Vietnam War. He married Diane Moore January 22, 1966. They later divorced. He then married Barbara Stern December 28, 1974 in Waterloo. She preceded him in death April 9, 2007. Bill was a forklift driver for John Deere at the downtown site for 30 years, retiring in 1995. He also farmed his land for many years. He was a member of UAW Local 838 and the LaPorte City American Legion Post No. 207, USS San Diego. A memorial visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. on Thursday, March 14th at LOC in LaPorte City, 606 East Main Street, LaPorte City. A private family graveside service will be held at Westview Cemetery in LaPorte City, where military honors will be conducted by Iowa Army National Guard Funeral Honor Guard. A memorial fund will be established. Fenton Forsyth, 65, of Waterloo, passed away Thursday, March 7th, at his home. He was born on December 23, 1958, in Waterloo. He graduated from Central High School in 1977. After graduation, Fenton worked at Schoitz Hospital in Waterloo, Waterloo Leisure Services, and Porky's Red Carpet. Funeral services will be held on Saturday, March 16th at 10:30 a.m. at Lock Garden View Chapel, 3655 Logan Avenue, Waterloo. Visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the service at the Garden View Chapel. Interment will follow services at the Garden of Memories Cemetery. Viola Minnie Drolly Roberts, 99, of Grundy Center, died Sunday, March 3rd, at her home in Grundy Center. Visitation will be Sunday, March 10th, 5 to 7 p.m. at Abel's Funeral and Cremation Service, Engelkes Chapel in Grundy Center. A funeral service will be 11 a.m. on Monday, March 11th, at the American Lutheran Church in Grundy Center. Joseph Glazer, 92, of New Hampton, died Friday, March 8th. Mass of Christian burial will be held 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, March 13th, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in North Washington. Visitation 3 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, March 12th, at Hugeback Johnson Funeral Home in New Hampton, and an hour prior to the service at the church. Stephen E., known as Steve Suzik, 70 of Waterloo passed away on Wednesday, March 6th at his home. Visitation will be held on Wednesday, March 13th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Lock at Tower Park, 4140 Kimball Avenue in Waterloo. There will be no formal service, and interment will be held at a later date in Kansas City, Missouri. Memorials to the family. Betty Jane Lomp, 99, of Cedar Falls, passed away at New Aldea Lifescapes. Visitation 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, March 14th at Dahl Van Hove Schoof Funeral Home, 1825 West 12th Street, Cedar Falls. Interment at Garden of Memories on Friday, March 15th at 10:30 a.m. And on to sports. In a recap of the weekend high school boys basketball competition, a spectacular season that captivated the city of Hudson this winter came one victory short of a storybook ending. A red-hot Western Christian won its state record 11th state title with a 78-51 victory over Hudson in the Class 2A state championship game at Wells Fargo Arena. The Wolfpack tied a state single-game record with 15 three-pointers as they used a dominating third quarter to break open a tight game. MOC Floyd Valley was the last team to make 15 in a game. That came in 1990. The Wolfpack finished 15 of 28 from three-point range in the game, trailing by 7 at half, 40-33. The third quarter and the game went sideways for Hudson from the start. Wolfpack star Caden Van Ragenmoeder kissed a three-pointer off the backboard from the left wing to open the quarter, and then Karsten Murray connected on three triples as the Wolfpack outscored the Pirates 22-5 in the third to take control of the game. Hudson never recovered. Caleb Duma, who had 7 three-pointers, and Moray, who had 5, led Western Christian with 23 points apiece. In his final game, Camden Davis led Hudson with 19 points. Tanner Michael had 9. Both Davis and Michael earned nods on the all-tournament team. Hudson was appearing in its first title game since 1993 and first state tournament since 1994. It was a remarkable run for a group of 10 seniors who 2 years ago were part of a team that won just 7 games, and following that season dedicated themselves to doing all the hard things to put together a special season. Despite the loss, the 2023-24 season was special for the Pirates. "This was no accident," said Coach Leonard. "These guys deserved this and earned it with what they have done the last 3 seasons and 2 off-seasons that saw them put in so much time. Nobody knows how much time they put in except for them." When Waverly Shellrock is at its best, it is flying all over the court, and that was the case early. Benny Ramker scored on 3 drives to the hoop, and Cole Marsh nailed a 3-pointer as the Gohawks jumped out to a 9-2 lead in the first 3 minutes. Waverly Shellrock led 19-11 after 1, but then Assumption began to get to the basket on dribble penetration and chipped into the lead before taking it and leading 31-29 at halftime. Then, in the second half, Noah Frazel picked up his 3rd and 4th fouls in the first 36 seconds of the quarter. After falling behind by 6, Marsh rallied the Gohawks to within 37-36 through 3 quarters. Then Noah Frazel scored inside with 7 minutes and 38 seconds left in the game, and the Gohawks had their first lead since the 2:29 mark of the second quarter. But with 5 minutes and 27 seconds left in the game, Noah Frazel was called for a block in the lane and fouled out. His absence was felt down the stretch. A Jude Landers layup on a nifty pass from Ramker made it 44-41 with 4 minutes and 12 seconds left. But the Gohawks did not make another field goal in the game. And without Frazel, Waverly Shellrock had to alter what they did. Playing in their fourth state title game in program history, the Gohawks led early, fell behind, rallied, and then came up a play short. Ramker finished with 10 points, and Louis Portillo had 13 rebounds. Marsh and Luke Frazel, who had 31 in Waverly Shellrock's semifinal win over MOC Floyd Valley, were named to the all-tournament team. And the Northeast Iowa players are named to the IPSWA All-State team. Metro players Cade Corbett and Anthony Galvin from Cedar Falls and Drew Wagner from Waterloo Christian have been named to the Iowa Print Sports Writers Association All-State Boys Basketball team. Corbett and Galvin were each named to the third team in Class 4A. On a balanced squad that played a rotation of 10 players evenly, Corbett averaged 10.8 points and 5.7 rebounds a game. Galvin, who missed 9 games during the season due to injury, was second on the team in scoring 11.4 points per game. The duo helped the Tigers reach the Class 4A state tournament. Wagner earned second-team honors in Class 1A following a career that saw him score more than 1,800 career points and grab more than 600 career rebounds. Class 3A state runner-up Waverly Shellrock had 3 players earn all-state nods. Cole Marsh, the future Iowa Hawkeye football player, was named to the first team after averaging 16.1 points, 5.6 rebounds, and 3.2 assists for the Gohawks. Luke Frazel made the second team. He led Waverly Shellrock with an 18.7 PPG average, and he was the team's top rebounder at 7.2 per game. Noah Frazel was selected to the third team following a season that saw him average 16.4 points per game. Decorah's Ben Bookman was a 3A first team honoree, and Independent senior Josh Beatty made the third team in 3A after leading the Mustangs in scoring at 14 points per game. In Class 2A, several Northeast Iowa athletes were placed on the team. Hudson's Camden Davis, who helped the Pirates reach the 2A title game, was a first-team pick. He averaged 19.3 points and 9.9 rebounds a game for Hudson. Pirate senior teammate Lyle Olson made the third team. The point guard averaged 10.5 points, 5.4 assists, and 1.9 steals per game. Jessup's Jack Miller, who scored 597 points this year and finished with more than 1,700 career points. Applington Parkersburg's Gavin Thomas was a second-team pick. He averaged 20.3 points a game for the Falcons during his senior campaign. On the third team in Class 2A, Grundy Center junior Jalen Kirkpatrick led the Spartans to the state tournament, averaging 15.9 points a game. Dyke New Hartford leading scorer Colin Meester, a junior, was a third-team pick after averaging 16.1 points per game. In Class 1A, Dunkerton's Dylan Marquardt made the third team after averaging 17.4 points per game for the Raiders. Gladbrook Reinbrecht junior Drew Eilers averaged 12.3 points and 10.3 rebounds for the state tournament qualifying Rebels and was also a third-team selection. Northwestern College commit Jesse Van Kalsbeek of MOC Floyd Valley was named Mr. Basketball. Van Kalsbeek averaged 26 points and 10.8 rebounds a game. The 6'7" forward led the Dutchman to the 3A state semifinals, where they lost to Waverly Shellrock. And in college women's basketball, the Northern Iowa women's basketball team picked up a 67-46 win over Evansville in its regular season finale on Saturday. With the win, the Panthers improved to 15-14, rising above 500 for the first time since November, and earned the 4 seed in the Missouri Valley Conference Women's Basketball Tournament, Hoops in the Heartland. The Panthers rode a 10-0 run to a 10-2 lead in the first quarter, finishing the opening frame with a 14-4 advantage. UNI continued to stymie the Purple Aces' offense, allowing just 8 points in the second quarter to take a 25-12 halftime lead. UNI dropped 25 points in the fourth quarter to swell its final advantage to 21 points. Maya McDermott led the Panthers with 17 points, while Grace Buffelli managed an 11-point, 11-rebound double-double. KB Lauby also scored 11 for the Panthers. Navia Thomas scored a game-high 19 points to lead Evansville. As the 4 seed UNI receives a bye in the first round of Hoops in the Heartland and will face the winner of a first-round matchup between Illinois and the Purple Aces. UNI's first matchup in Moline will be on Friday, March 15th at 2:30 p.m., with broadcast coverage provided by ESPN Plus and the Panther Sports Radio Network on 106.5 FM Corn Country, KCFI. Wartburg advances to the Division III Final Four. For the third time in program history, the Wartburg College women's basketball team has earned a trip to the Division III Final Four. One night, after Macy Harris lifted the Knights past Bates College with a last-second layup in a Sweet 16 game, Wartburg led from start to finish in beating Washington and Lee 68-58 Saturday at Rhode Island College. The Knights led 13-10 after one quarter, but then took control of the game with 24 second-quarter points to surge to a 37-25 halftime lead. Washington and Lee closed within 5 after 3 quarters, but Wartburg pulled away late for the double-digit win. Wartburg led for 32 minutes and 39 seconds in the game and led by as much as 16. Washington and Lee's final lead of the game came with 2 minutes and 54 seconds left in the first quarter. The Knights also advanced to the Final Four in 2016 and 2018. Jaden Murphy had 23 points, 8 rebounds, 3 assists, 3 steals, and 2 blocked shots to lead Wartburg. Jaden will be the 4th Murphy sister to have played in a Division III Final Four for the Wartburg, joining Miranda and Megan on 2016 team, Miranda, Megan, and Riley on 2018 team. Harris added 17, and Sarah Faber had 13. Wartburg will play Smith College of Northampton, Massachusetts in a national semifinal March 14th at the Capital Center Performance Arena in Columbus, Ohio. And a red-hot Indiana State ends the UNI's men's basketball season. Northern Iowa never found an answer for Indiana State's red-hot offense as the Sycamores dealt the Panthers a 94-72 beatdown in the Missouri Valley Conference semifinals on Saturday. The Sycamores shot 57.4% from the field and 15 of 29, 51.7%, from three-point range in the win over the Panthers, who managed a 41% shooting clip. In their previous meeting with the Panthers, the Sycamores also managed to drill 15 threes, albeit on 34 attempts. Like they had in their earlier meeting, the Sycamores rode a three-point barrage into the lead, hitting 5 threes in the first 5 minutes of the contest. Sophomore center Robbie Avila connected on 4 of the Sycamores' early triples to lead the opening charge. 5 points from junior center Jacob Hudson helped buoy the Panthers until the first media timeout with 15 minutes and 3 seconds remaining in the first half, down 17-8. The Sycamores did not remain on pace for 40 three-pointers for the remainder of the first half, but hit two more triples over the next 6 minutes to storm out to a 34-15 lead. Trailing by 19, the Panthers limited the Sycamores to 3 of 11 from the floor over the final 9 minutes, allowing the Panthers to cut the lead to 8 with a Cole Henry jumper with a minute and 44 seconds remaining in the half. A free throw and buzzer-beating jumper from Ryan Conwell allowed Indiana State to regain a double-digit 44-33 lead at halftime. Following his early 5 points, Hudson continued to drive the Panthers' offense with 13 total points in the first half. Freshman guard R.J. Taylor also came up big with 5 points, 3 steals, and 3 rebounds during UNI's rally. Avila led all players with a game-high 14 through 20 minutes. A 9-2 Indiana State surge to open the second half gave the Sycamores a 16-point 53-37 lead by the first media timeout of the second half, with 15 minutes and 35 seconds to play in regulation. An Isaiah Swoop triple made it a 20-point game, 62-42, with less than 3 minutes late, as the Sycamores' half-opening surge extended to a 29 run. UNI managed to trim the lead to less than 20 points once over the final 13 minutes of action, but the Panthers never managed to slow the Sycamores' red-hot offense in the second half. Indiana State shot 19 of 30 in the second half to secure the win and advance to the conference championship. Indiana State shot 19 of 30. Avila led Indiana State with 21 points. Conwell posted a 20-point, 13-rebound double-double for the Sycamores. Julian Larry and Swoop also finished in double figures for the Sycamores. Hudson led UNI with 21 points. Bowen Bourne and Nate Heise finished in double figures. With the loss, UNI's season comes to a close, barring an invitation to a postseason tournament, with a record of 19-14 overall. UNI's 19 wins are 5 more than it had in the 22-23 season. The loss ended a 4-game winning streak for the Panthers, who won 5 of its last 7. And this article comes from the Associated Press. When a motion detector went off overnight at Comrie Middle School, a police dispatcher called up a digital map of the building, pinpointed the detector, clicked on a live feed from the nearest camera, and relayed the intruder's location to responding police. Within moments, they captured the culprit, a teenager dressed in dark clothes and a ski mask, but carrying no weapon. The map and cameras let the dispatcher keep things from becoming super escalated, said the school's security director, Jim Blodgett. The dispatcher could see that it looked like a student, just kind of goofing around in the building. Spurred by mass shootings, thousands of school districts have hired companies to produce detailed digital maps that can help police, firefighters, and medical professionals respond more quickly in emergencies. The Middleton Cross Plains Area School District, where the teenage trespasser entered from a roof hatch, was an early adopter in Wisconsin, which has since provided mapping grants to about 200 districts. More than 20 states have enacted or proposed digital school mapping measures in the past few years, according to an Associated Press analysis aided by the bill tracking software Plural. Florida approved $14 million in grants last year, Michigan allotted $12.5, New Jersey allocated $12.3 in federal pandemic relief funds to complete digital maps of every school in the state. Critical Response Group, run by an Army Special Operations veteran, has been driving the trend. The New Jersey-based company's CEO, Mike Rogers, recently told lawmakers in Maryland how he used gridded digital maps during deployments and was surprised the school where his wife taught had nothing similar. So he mapped her school, then expanded to 12,000 schools and counting nationwide.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Shortly after modern humans arrived in Europe, the Neanderthals disappeared, and scientists think we had something to do with it. Neanderthals, or their direct ancestors, migrated out of Africa and into the Middle East and Europe around 250,000 years ago. Soon, they were well adapted to the environment. Large eyes help them see in the longer nights and darker winters. Stout bodies help them retain heat and handle large prey, and provided space for the large liver and kidneys needed for a diet heavy in protein. Their brains were as big as ours, but spent processing power on their greater visual and motor abilities. This may not have allowed them to develop higher communication or conceptual thinking to match ours, which may have been their downfall. Modern humans arrived on the scene 45,000 years ago, less physically adapted, but more mentally adaptable. We had cooperative hunting methods superior to the Neanderthals, allowing us to outcompete them for food, and perhaps reducing the large herbivore populations that they depended on. We also had superior tools and weapons. When there were conflicts between the groups, as there have been among tribes throughout history, our superior technology probably allowed us to prevail. But we weren't only fighting. There must have been considerable interbreeding, since we can find 1-3% of the Neanderthal genome in modern man. Which means the Neanderthals never completely disappeared. A little bit of them is alive in us today. I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.